You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, Congress will have a new Speaker of the House next year, but who? Well, it depends on which party wins in the midterms and by how much. We'll talk to a congressional reporter about how things could play out. First, the CIA's covert drone program is expanding its operations to Africa. The agency's use of drones had been scaled back under the Obama administration after it was criticized for not being transparent enough. Now the Trump administration is ramping the program back up with new operations in the Sahara Desert region. Eric Schmidt covers national security and terrorism for the New York Times. He's one of the reporters who broke this story. He's also co-author of Counterstrike, the untold story of America's secret campaign against Al-Qaeda. Eric, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
This is a region of the world, I think, that for a lot of Americans isn't on the radar in the war on terror. What will this drone program theoretically be targeting?
Well, what the CIA and people close to the CIA is likely targeting are groups of insurgents that are massing in the southern part of Libya, which is right across the border. These would both be Al-Qaeda as well as ISIS fighters. There have been already military drone strikes in this part of Libya over the past several months. And there's a lot of concern that some of the fighters who had been up in the northern part of Libya are now trying to escape and filter back down into this southern part. It's kind of a relatively ungoverned space, border area in northern Niger and Libya. And so that's caused a great deal of concern, especially after the ambush last fall in a different part of Niger that killed four army troops. That was kind of a wake-up call for both the military and the CIA that they needed to do a better job of monitoring this area for different kind of Islamist radicals.
Now, part of the story here, as you mentioned, is who is running this drone program? You mentioned there were already military drone strikes in this region. Why is it significant that the CIA now will have its apparently own operation?
Well, as you mentioned in an introduction, what's happened is under the Obama administration, there was a move, particularly at the end of the administration, to shift the armed drone strike program away from largely the CIA, which has been conducting these kind of strikes for years in places like Pakistan, and move it on to the military, with the thinking being that these are sensitive operations. Certainly some of these strikes over the years have killed civilians accidentally, and so it's best to put in the hands of the military where they can be, you know, hopefully more transparent in these kind of strikes. So the significance here in the Trump administration is the pendulum is moving back now where you can have a covert program of drone strikes, where you'd have drones operated by the CIA alongside military drones that would be operated at different bases, at least, you know, two right now in southern parts of different parts of Niger. So you'd have one that theoretically would be more transparent in its operations and one that would not be.
What's been the argument from the Trump administration for bringing the CIA back into these drone operations?
Well, Mike Pompeo, when he was CIA director, he made a very forceful argument to President Trump that it didn't make sense, at least to him, to hamstring any of the nation's counterterrorism capabilities, and particularly those that belong to the CIA. So what he argued was not just in drones, but in all sorts of capabilities, raids, anything else that could go after extremists, and not just in this part of Africa, but also in Afghanistan and other places, where there'd been essentially a division of labor, where the military would take the lead, the CIA would be supporting, you know, largely in a surveillance or monitoring role, as well as its analytical capabilities. Pompeo came in and said, that doesn't make sense. We're fighting an enemy, a global enemy here, whether it's ISIS or Al-Qaeda, we should use all the country's resources, including whatever the CIA can bring to the fight.
Talking to Eric Schmidt from the New York Times about the CIA getting back into drone operations based in Niger, operating around the Sahara Desert region. Eric, regardless of who was running it, the military or the CIA, we did see a big ramp up of the use of drones and counterterrorism operations under the Obama administration. Is that right?
That's correct. There was quite a sharp increase, particularly in the latter years of the Obama administration, especially in places like Yemen and Somalia. The president, for all his caution, President Obama, that is, was very aggressive in stepping up these kind of strikes. He also put a number of legal restrictions on them in order to hopefully reduce the number of civilian casualties that might be caused accidentally. Many of these kind of restrictions were lifted as the Trump administration came in, under following President Trump's campaign promise to kind of unleash the U.S. military and other security services to deal one last blow, hopefully, to defeat the Islamic State in places like Iraq and Syria, and chase it down in other places and many of its affiliates around the world.
Getting back to the CIA being a drone operator, in effect, one of the weird situations you've mentioned in your reporting was at least one case where there had been a CIA drone strike. This is under still the Obama administration. Everyone on the planet knew it was the CIA, but the U.S. government couldn't talk about it because it was the CIA. Can you talk about that?
That's right. And many of the drone strikes in Pakistan became this way. It was like the worst kept secret, in not just in Washington, but around the world, that whenever there was some kind of missile strike or an airstrike in the tribal areas, that is, these areas right along the Afghan border inside of Pakistan, where you had particularly al-Qaeda fighters massing and some others groups, that the CIA wouldn't comment on these, where it became very clear. And you had various officials over the years. Leon Panetta famously let slip that the CIA conducted these kind of strikes, to the point where, you know, it was really, again, it was very, you know, just very thinly veiled that the CIA was conducting these operations. Nonetheless, President Obama and his team under John Brennan as director of the CIA felt it was in the best interest of the country to be more transparent. They felt the military would be able to do that more, even though the CIA argued it was actually, it had better analysts and was more accurate in its strikes. The Obama administration was trying to shift that away as it left office toward the military. They didn't quite succeed. There was quite a bit of resistance by the CIA and its supporters in Congress. So that program really never died completely.
You've also reported that, especially after those four U.S. troops died in Niger, there's been talk of withdrawing some or all of U.S. forces there. Is this idea then that the forces on the ground would be replaced by these drone operations?
Well, interesting enough, you would have this seeming anomaly where you're going to be withdrawing troops on the ground, many of them Green Berets who've been working closely with the Nigerian troops, training them and helping them fight different extremist groups. But there's been no suggestion that the U.S. would pull back on its intelligence, surveillance, and reconnaissance capabilities, a fancy way of saying the drones that provide surveillance for these different threats. And these, interestingly enough, these are not only drones that would support operations by the U.S. and its Nigerian hosts, but also France, which plays a very important role, not only in Niger, but much of West Africa. And essentially what the U.S. has done is struck a deal with the French, of course, the former colonial power in that part of Africa, that they will help support the French if the French provide the vast amount of manpower on the ground in terms of troops. So that's kind of a trade-off here, even as the U.S. is now seemingly on a path toward drawing down its troops, at least in Niger, where it had about 800 troops right now. It's still going to maintain these drones that will help provide surveillance for U.S., Nigerian, and French troops, and from time to time carry out these kind of strikes, particularly against what they call high-value targets, senior al-Qaeda or Islamic State operatives.
Briefly, as we wrap up, is the government of Niger itself enthusiastically on board with the idea of a CIA drone base and other drone operations?
Well, they're not talking about it publicly, at least not very much. We interviewed the interior minister, Mr. Bazoum, and he would basically say only that these are American aircraft. He wouldn't go any more detail. But Niger faces so many threats from different parts, from north, from the west, and from the south, that they've been welcoming of any kind of American assistance in this regard.
We'll leave it there for now. Eric, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you very much.
That's Eric Schmidt, national security reporter for the New York Times, with us to talk about the CIA's expansion of its covert drone program into Africa. First, with Paul Ryan of Wisconsin set to retire from Congress, there will be a new Speaker of the House next year, one way or another. Who that is going to be, though, remains to be seen. Republicans are hoping to hold on to the speakership by maintaining control of the House in the midterm elections, but if they lose 23 seats or more, Democrats will be in the driver's seat. That would set up a potential struggle between former Speaker Nancy Pelosi and a younger group of Democrats who are saying they want new leadership from a younger generation. Scott Wong is a senior staff writer at The Hill, where he's been covering Paul Ryan and House Republicans. He's here to help us sort things out. Scott, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
Well, before we get into either party, it always seems to me that House Speaker, in a lot of ways, is just the worst job. And people come out of it bruised and battered. And I remember John Boehner, the incredible look of relief on his face when he left. This is a tough job, right?
That's right. If you remember, John Boehner, on his last day of office as Speaker of the House, was singing Zippity-Doo-Dah. on his way out of his final press conference. And I imagine Paul Ryan's going to have a similar feeling as he leaves office in January, handing the reins to somebody we don't quite know who that will be yet. There's just so many questions that are up in the air.
Let's start digging into this. Let's start with Democrats who are projected to pick up seats. They could win control of the House. They could win by a lot. They could win by a nose. What are you hearing from Democrats? Is it a shoo-in for Nancy Pelosi again or not?
I think it's really going to depend on the size of the pickup for Democrats. Let's say that they do take back the House, and it's a blue wave, meaning there will be 30 to 40 seats, possibly more, of a pickup. In that case, I think Nancy Pelosi can make a very strong case to her caucus that she should return as Speaker of the House. The last thing I think Democrats want to do after taking back control of the House is to have a big public battle in front of the TV cameras and in front of the political media, showing that the party is divided. Instead, I think what they want to do is to show that they're united against President Trump and the Republican agenda, and I think that's the case that Nancy Pelosi would make if they win by a large margin. If it's a small margin, only perhaps a 5-seat advantage, I think there's going to be a real push to have a changing of the guards, not only Nancy Pelosi perhaps, but also her number two and number three Democratic lieutenants, Steny Hoyer from Maryland and Jim Clyburn from South Carolina. And so, there's so many things that are unknown at this point, including who's going to control the majority. There's just an unlimited range of scenarios at this point.
Now, we know that Republicans have targeted Nancy Pelosi, including in this midterm election. Many candidates are running against her. What are the pros and cons from the perspective of the Democratic caucus, though? What do people like? Why do some people want to see a change of leadership?
Well, I think in the pro-Pelosi camp, what we're hearing is that these are, very unusual times. Donald Trump is a unusual president, an unconventional president, and that it's going to take somebody with political experience and know-how to go up against somebody like Donald Trump. And so I think in the pro-Pelosi camp, people are saying Nancy Pelosi has been in Democratic politics for decades. She's seen these types of scenarios before, and she is best equipped to lead the party, in these next few years while Donald Trump is president. In the sort of anti-Pelosi camp, the anti-establishment camp, you're seeing some of the younger generation. They're more diverse. They are pushing the party further to the left with things like talking about impeachment of Donald Trump and universal health care. And so they feel like that Nancy Pelosi and some of the leadership has led the party astray. They want to get back to sort of their more core liberal values and believe that a sort of wholesale changing of the guard is needed to do so.
Who are some of the people that are viewed as, possible successors to Nancy Pelosi?
Well, I did mention Jim Clyburn, the number three Democrat. He's been in Congress for decades. He's from South Carolina. He is African American. He is somebody who can be seen as sort of a bridge. Maybe if the Democratic Party is not quite ready to make a major switch and go with somebody from the new generation, Clyburn is seen as somebody who can sort of bridge the divide. And I think that's sort of how he is positioning himself. I think Steny Hoyer, who has been wanting to lead the Democratic Party for quite some time, it's not quite clear that he would be the obvious successor to Pelosi just because he's up there in age, and the Democratic Party is becoming younger, more diverse, and quite frankly, more female. And so I'm not sure Steny Hoyer would be the right face for the Democratic Party. But there's a number of people, you know, some who are people like Barbara Lee. She's from Oakland, a former Congressional Black Caucus member. Others like Linda Sanchez. She formerly led the Congressional Hispanic Caucus. So there are a number of people just sort of positioning themselves, not quite sure what they're going to be running for, but positioning themselves in case there is sort of this changing of the guard.
And before we leave the Democrats and look at the Republican side of things, if Democrats lose, if they fail to take the House, obviously they're not picking a House Speaker, but does that suggest that a big change of leadership might be in the works?
Yeah, I think there's no question that if Democrats fail, you know, for a third consecutive cycle to take back control of the House, Nancy Pelosi would be gone, and probably the rest of her leadership team as well. So that's sort of a no-brainer. And then that would usher in a new generation of leaders.
Talking to Scott Wong from The Hill, looking at who might replace Paul Ryan as Speaker of the House after November's elections. Now let's turn to the Republican side of things, Scott. If they manage to hang on to their majority, House Speaker Paul Ryan, who you've been covering for quite a while now, isn't coming back. So they've got to pick somebody new. Who is, I guess, is there an establishment choice to replace Paul Ryan, first of all?
Well, I think we have to say that the establishment pick or the front runner at this point is Kevin McCarthy. He is the number two Republican in leadership, the majority leader, a close ally of Paul Ryan. In fact, Paul Ryan has already endorsed him and said that he prefers Kevin McCarthy to succeed him as Speaker of the House should Republicans maintain the majority. He's also somebody who's close to Donald Trump and has aligned himself with Donald Trump very early on in the presidential campaign. But again, there, you know, each of these candidates has sort of their pros and cons. And for McCarthy, who actually ran to succeed John Boehner back in 2015, he actually failed and dropped out of that speaker's race after it became apparent that he just could not amass the 218 votes needed to be elected speaker on the House floor. That paved the way for Paul Ryan. And so we've seen McCarthy stumble in the past, and many people think that McCarthy could stumble again.
And if he does, who else is out there maybe jockeying for position right now?
Yeah, definitely. The number three Republican, Steve Scalise, the majority whip, who, of course, was nearly fatally shot last year during a congressional baseball practice. He's seen as somebody who is positioning himself to step in should McCarthy stumble and fail to reach the speakership. And so he's out there campaigning for candidates, raising money, trying to not only keep the majority but also form alliances with some of his fellow lawmakers who will be responsible for electing the next Speaker of the House. And that sort of created this rivalry between the number two and number three Republicans, Kevin McCarthy and Steve Scalise.
Are there insurgent candidates? We've seen in the past speakers brought down or prevented from taking the seat in the first place by kind of the even more conservative wing of the party. They can tear down a speaker. They haven't managed to put their own in their place, though, right?
That's right. I think you're referring to the House Freedom Caucus, the group of sort of rabble-rousing conservatives led by Mark Meadows and Jim Jordan. Jordan from Ohio has already announced a bid for the speakership. This is something that he's been flirting with for quite some time, and he finally did pull the trigger and jump into the speaker's race. So Kevin McCarthy will be squaring off with at least one other candidate in Jim Jordan. Of course, Jim Jordan has been dogged by allegations that he turned a blind eye towards some sexual abuse of college athletes by a team doctor back when Jordan was serving as a wrestling coach at Ohio State University. So, like I mentioned before, everyone sort of has their pros and cons, political baggage. If you've served in this arena for a number of years, you, of course, get dragged down by political baggage, and Jim Jordan is no exception.
Is it a case where if Republicans do keep the majority, if President Trump puts his finger on the scale and says publicly or behind the scenes, yeah, I like this candidate, could he have a lot of sway?
I think so. I think President Trump could be the decider in a race for Speaker of the House. As I mentioned, he's extremely close to Kevin McCarthy, but he's also close to a number of these other candidates. You know, in a State of the Union address, he called Steve Scalise the legend from Louisiana. He's also very close to Mark Meadows and Jim Jordan of the House Freedom Caucus. So I really think that if it came down to a matter of votes, a handful of votes, to decide the speakership, President Trump could weigh in either with a tweet or with some personal phone calls to members of Congress and could actually sway this election. We probably won't know the answer to that, until after the election, when these sort of internal races will be held.
We'll leave it there for now. Scott, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thanks so much.
Scott Wong is a senior staff writer at The Hill, where he covers House Republicans. He was with us to look at the race to be the next Speaker of the House in 2019. Now, the Green Bay Packers kicked off the regular season last night with an amazing 24-23 comeback victory over the Chicago Bears at Lambeau Field. A lot of people are happy to once again have football as part of the weekend routine, but there are some question marks on the future of the game. Concussions have led to lawsuits and rules changes. In January of this year, the New York Times reported on a legislative push in that state to ban youth tackle football. Other states are considering similar measures. As a result, our next guest says football is under siege, and that's not counting the politics involving the national anthem and declining TV viewership. But while the sport may be in trouble, he says there are lots of important benefits that make the game worth saving. Bob Cassiola played offensive tackle at Princeton University and is a former coach there. He's also the former president of the National Football Foundation and the College Football Hall of Fame. He's the author of the new book, First and Forever, Making the Case for the Future of Football. Bob, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you, Rob. It's a pleasure.
Before we get to the future of the game, I want to talk to you about some of your early football memories. There's one memory you say that made you fall in love with football. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, it was when the head coach, he's a Hall of Fame coach, his name was Charlie Caldwell, came to visit me. I was all of 17 years old, and he was recruiting me for Princeton. And at the end of his talk, after he talked about the school, he pointed his finger at me, right by me, and he said, "You know, Bob, I'm not talking about the next 4 years of your life. I'm talking about the next 40-plus and the influence this can have on you." I never forgot that. I used it many times in my own recruiting bouts, and I can assure you that I think if you read this book and looked at the people in it, you realize that they looked at the game, and it turned out to be the next 40 years were so important.
And you profile a lot of people. This is kind of a memoir. You're sharing your love of the game as well. A lot of the people you profile, they aren't, you know, Hall of Fame stars that are household names everywhere, but they're people you say their lives were affected for the better by football, whether they ended up playing football in their life or not. What lessons do you take, do all these people take from playing the game that helps them, even off the field?
Well, it's interesting you should ask that question, because almost every one of them suffered some type of injury, some major, some minor. But they never, as you talk to them now, 30, 40 years later, they refer to the game as the heart and soul of their dreams, one that opened up opportunities to them. And when they look back, they regard it as a great experience for them because of several things. First of all, team. To be able to play on a team with 11, even more if you played offense and defense. Play on a team dedicated to going out and doing the best you can, hopefully winning. But if you didn't, you still came back as a team. And it endeared you. It was like a fabric of American life. It endeared you to each other. That was one. And I think the most important thing, too, for any of them was the fact that the sport itself gave them an opportunity to get an education and then to pick and choose what they wanted to do for the next 40 years of their life.
Now, you have come out with this book in the midst of this concern about concussions, long-term risks to brain health. Does that have you worried about fans of the game wanting to watch it, people wanting to have their kids play it?
Oh, absolutely. I think you've got to be concerned because now it's become very highly publicized and it's factual. But things are being done, and I think it's nothing like it's similar to what happened many years ago with this game back when Teddy Roosevelt put a lot of pressure on people to change the rules of the game way back in the early teens or else it wasn't going to be banned, and they did. And you're starting to see that, Rob. You're starting to see that just now. Perhaps you're aware of it. The state of Texas, a hotbed for football, has introduced their every high school coach, whether he be varsity, junior varsity, or freshman, had to take a course this summer and pass it in the fundamentals of proper tackling or else they couldn't coach. And it's going to move on to other states in the country. So what they're doing is they're changing an attitude in the coach's mind, how they coach, and what they should teach to properly teach ways of not using your head in the game. Back in the 60s is when the head became very prominent. And it came out of a part of the country where football was a hotbed. And we were at spring practices, and we came back one year when one of our coaches came back and said, you know, they're teaching a new technique in the Southeast Conference. And it's all about putting that head in the center of the chest so you had balance when you went to tackle a guy. For years, tackling was with your shoulder. Matter of fact, Bobby Bowden in the last chapter of this book talks about playing and tackling with his shoulder and teaching people to tackle with their shoulder. So I think you're going to come back. They're getting away from the head and going back to the fundamentals of the shoulder. And then there's other things that are happening. I don't want to, you know, you have other things we want to get to, but there's a coach up at Dartmouth named Buddy Tevens who does not have his team hit during the week. They never have contact. They work against dummies, and all kinds of practices are geared around doing something against something that is mobile, that they can hit and move, but it's not another body. So therefore, over the last 4 years that he's instituted this, he has records that shows that he's cutting down on injuries within his own team. And I think things like that are occurring. I think you'll see it all over the country, and I think it's absolutely necessary.
Talking to Bob Cassiola about his new book, First and Forever, Making the Case for the Future of Football. Let's go to that the younger level of football. What do you think needs to happen to make sure the game is safe for kids getting into it and to make sure that parents let their kids get into it in the first place?
I think that's the key. Somebody asked me why I wrote the book. I said, truthfully, if a parent, mother or father, reads this book or parts of it and comes away feeling positive about it, maybe they'll let their kid play. That's all I care about. What is going down? I think you're going to see more and more on the younger level, less of the physical part of it, maybe more of the touch part of it, or coming to where they don't have the hitting is involved. And therefore, building kids to where they're getting strong, learning fundamentals. You know, I know that there are places where things are happening within towns. Identities are changing. I use Pennsylvania as an example, where places which were a hotbed for high school football were having problems now fielding teams. And a lot had to do with the fact that the climate, the population base of the towns had changed. Industries had moved on, coal industry, for example. And when they moved on, the retailers went with them. And also, what had happened then was they couldn't find enough people that used to be anxious to get out and play sports and play football in hopes of leaving all that atmosphere and getting an education. I think all of that is changing now to where, as you know, they're limiting the numbers in certain schools because they don't have enough players, and I think that's okay as long as kids are involved, because if they will play the game at some level when they're young and enjoy it, perhaps when they get to high school, they'll want to play more. And in that way, we're preserving the game.
Talking about the state of football with Bob Cassiola, former president of the National Football Foundation and the College Football Hall of Fame, also former player and coach himself. He says, despite increasing pressures and criticism of the game, it's worth saving, especially for today's youth. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Are you a football fan, or have recent controversies involving the flag, head injuries, other things turned you off, or both at the same time? Do you or would you let your kids play football, encourage them to play the game, What do you think of what our guest calls the upside of football? Teamwork, acceptance, success, and failure. Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our conversation about the positive aspects of football, teamwork, acceptance, and more that our guest says make the game worth saving. Bob Cassiola is former president of the National Football Foundation. His new book is First and Forever, Making the Case for the Future of Football. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you think football is in trouble and needs to be saved? Have you played or coached yourself? What positive things do you see for you or for kids who play the game? Or would you not let your kids play football knowing what you know now? Call 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. To your calls now, Cindy is with us in Appleton. Cindy, hi.
Hello. Well, you talked about teamwork, acceptance, et cetera. Well, unfortunately, I think this day and age, even in like the grade school level, the high school level, and college level, it's not about that anymore. It's really all just about winning.
Cindy, thanks for the call. Bob, do you see that at maybe there's a level where we're worrying too much about winning when it should be more about the other stuff?
I think it's possible, yes. I mean, that's a very good point. And I think a lot of it, truthfully, comes from the fact that you see a lot of it on television. Whether you're watching an NFL game or a college game, the winning attitude and part of it is perhaps overemphasized, making idols out of some of these guys to a point because they're so good and they perform so well, but in the end, they win. And everybody likes to be on top. I know what that's all about. But I think, truthfully, I think it's up to the coaches. It can't be a national thing. I think the question is well-versed in the sense that we have to be aware of it. But I think a lot has to do with the atmosphere, the school a kid plays in, the coach he plays for. And he is the individual and his staff for the ones that bring about the proper attitude. Sure, they want to succeed. And that's important because they get a lot of satisfaction out of it. But the most important part of the game for me is to participate, to get in there and work and be a part of it. And then the rest, if it wins and you win, great. If not, you know what it is to succeed anyway because you've been part of something that you were dedicated to.
Thanks for that call. Go next to Scott in Allenton. Scott, hi.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. Love football. I have always loved football, but while playing in high school, I was ear-holed coming across the middle of tight end and went into films on Monday and didn't remember a single play from the second half. I played well, but I didn't remember a single play. And then I went on to college where my knee was irreparably destroyed. I pushed my son to play football because I didn't want him to graduate and think, man, I may have been pretty good at that. I wish I would have played. And he played and got out of the game unscathed. But I'm 52 years old. I'm starting to display some cognitive deficiency. And I don't think I'll have my grandchildren. I certainly won't push them to play. If they want to play, I'll support them. But I certainly won't push them to play.
Scott, thank you so much for calling and sharing your story, and sorry to hear about the cognitive decline now. Bob, Scott, you can hear ambivalent, a lot of mixed feelings there, and he's not alone.
Well, his personal experience is the key here, and I can understand it, and I can accept it, and I feel for him like you do, anybody would. But the fact is that he let his son play, and I think the fact that he did let his son play was encouraging enough that he had a chance to be a part of all the things I've been pushing here. I am very conscious of the fact that a lot of people have come out of this game with injuries. A lot of people come out of a lot of sports with injuries. But in football, it's there, sure. What we have to do is hopefully change some of the rules, change some of the teaching techniques, that you don't have people putting that helmet in somebody's ear, and get away from the fact that things like this can happen. But it's going to be a part of the game. I accept that. It's just a matter of how far we go with it.
Scott, thanks for the call. We'll go next to Christian in Columbus. Christian, hello.
Hey, yeah, I tell you what. I did not play high school football because of the social thing that was going on at the time. But I do have four boys, three of which are playing or played football, and I really enjoy it. And I tell you what, our youth coaches, they say something at the end of the practices, something like, thank you for being here. And when you go home, you thank your mom or your dad or whoever made it possible for you to be here, because it's important. And it's important that you be grateful for what you have. And that type of teamwork and esprit de corps is not found outside of team sports and the military.
Christian, thanks for the call. Bob, Christian, seeing some of the benefits you write about.
Wow. He ought to harness those coaches and get those coaches publicized locally. Let people know, let the community know that they exist and what they're doing, not just for the game, but just to let people know that's the way you got to live here. You got to live with each other. You got to be able to enjoy each other. And if you can play a game with each other and get into that atmosphere, it can't be any better. That's a great story, and I appreciate it very much.
Christian, thanks for that call. In our last few moments, I love a story you start the game with. You appreciate that football is kind of a melting pot. It brings people from different backgrounds, including you, when you heard on your transistor radio the name of Notre Dame's quarterback, Angelo Bertelli. Let's talk about that.
I was riding a bicycle around in my house. My brothers were all much older. They'd gone to the Second World War. I was like an only child, and I was home. I was probably 7 or 8 years old. They had all come back from the war. They were sitting on the porch with their buddies talking. They had a radio on, and I was just riding around, and I heard this radio, and I heard this name come across the radio. Angelo Bertelli scores for Notre Dame. And I rode up to the little porch they were sitting on. Finally, one of them looked down and said, "What's up?" I said, "I just heard a name on the radio, Angelo Bertelli. Is he Italian?" And my brother said, "Yes." And that's the true story. Now I go on to college and I play at Princeton, where I decided to go. And I'm all of maybe 18 years old. We've come back from our preseason practices of 100 strong. We're standing around on picture day in the stadium. And at the end of the stadium, people started milling around, and we were sitting together, a bunch of 18-year-old kids trying to hide, really, quite frankly, having come through 3 weeks of preseason practice. And this person, this individual, came walking down, and as he did, he was nodding and shaking hands, and he finally came to my group, and he came to me, and he stuck out his hand, and he says, "Nice to meet you. I'm Angelo Bertelli." Ah. And the station that did the radio games for Princeton was owned by a Princeton graduate, and he hired Angelo Bert, as they called him, to be the color announcer. And he was the color announcer through all my coaching career. And when I went on to work for the foundation, he was the first player out of Notre Dame to go into the College Hall of Fame.
And it's full circle there. We'll leave it. Thanks to Bob Cassiola. His new book is First and Forever, Making the Case for the Future of Football. This year, Wisconsin Public Radio goes beyond the ballot. We're asking people around the state what issues are important to them at election time. In Milwaukee's inner city, gun violence is a big concern and a fear, but residents say the root of the problem is lack of jobs, and they say it seems like politicians focus on flashy investments like the new Bucks Arena and Foxconn far from their neighborhoods. Jane Hamden reports.
My biggest issues in my neighborhood is the killing and just not the resources for the teens to have to be able to not be on the street.
The violence and poverty.
I have the issues with people killing up people, robbing people, breaking in people's houses.
At the Fondy Farmers Market on Milwaukee's north side, conversations about violence are a contrast to buckets of cut flowers and tables loaded down with tomatoes and zucchinis. Amanda Reed is a home health care worker. She's picking up ingredients for taco sauce and guacamole.
It's nice because it's fresh and, you know, it's grown locally and hopefully not too many pesticides, you know.
Reed says she's not planning to vote in November. She's feeling pretty hopeless about her Milwaukee neighborhood after a spike in shootings this summer.
Places like over here is just broken, you know? Yeah, it's just Milwaukee just gets the short end of the stick.
The Fondy Farmers Market is held up as a success story, an answer to the crime and unemployment that plague one of Milwaukee's poorest zip codes. Ken Little works in city development. He says small investments like this chip away at the tough challenges.
Not trying to make excuses. You need to get rid of the crime. You need to get rid of the reckless driving and those kind of things like that. But opportunity and access to employment, I think, are those things that lift the community and that will help change those kind of things.
Milwaukee officials tried hard to get Amazon to put a distribution center in the Century City development on Capitol Drive, but Amazon said it was too far from the highway. Ken Little says, maybe, but the fact is, the inner city scares people away. Advocates say it's time to forget about the Amazons and focus on small local businesses like Good City Brewing, which did commit to Century City.
So we're walking now to the corner of 27th and State.
A couple miles south of the farmers market, Evan Goyke offers a tour of his neighborhood.
You can see on the northeast corner, you have two abandoned boarded-up buildings, a former theater, and there are groups working to revitalize those. But on the other corner, we have a Cash for Gold store.
Goyke represents Wisconsin's 18th Assembly District. His house is a grand old Victorian turned into a boarding house. He and his wife are slowly restoring it, but some would say it's a risky investment. His block is like hundreds in Milwaukee. It's a mix of empty, crumbling structures and renovated gems with flower pots out front. Goyke says his neighborhood doesn't need a huge development project. What it needs is a grocery store.
There isn't an entity on my block of 27th Street that needs $10 million, but there's 10 businesses that need $100,000.
Back at the farmers market, Helen and James Perkins are shopping after church for their summer favorite, yellow squash and onions. Helen ran a daycare in the city for years. Now, as a retired small business owner, she sees politicians doing photo ops at Foxconn and the shiny Bucks Arena, but they never seem to come around to her corner of Milwaukee.
The inner city do need some help. There's no building up. Building up is everywhere else but in the inner city.
The Perkins will be voting in November, as they always do. They'll support candidates who believe Milwaukee's core neighborhoods are safe investments. For Wisconsin Public Radio, I'm Jane Hamden.
You can listen to other Beyond the Ballot stories at WPR.org/ballot.